All right, we are continuing our. Okay. I'm just making sure my recorder is working. We're continuing. This is actually the eighth shiur in the making of modern Judaism. Thank you all for coming. Last week we discussed kind of a really fascinating character in Rav Yehoshua, Fall Katz, and his. And his wife, the Rebbinson, the distinguished Rebbinson. And this week, I wanted to discuss Rav Mordechai Yaffe. But also in the context of discussing Rav Mordechai Yaffe, I also thought it appropriate to be discussing the Council of the Four, or the Three Lands as well, which I've mentioned on a number of occasions, but it's worth a discussion in and of itself. Also because in when we discuss kind of the bigger issues that affect Polish and Lithuanian and Ukrainian Jewry, they're also going to have play a major role, particularly in something that in Halacha they call Gzerot Tach V'Tat, the Chmelnytsky massacres, or the pogroms, I guess the pogroms by which all pogroms are judged. And then also immediately following that, Shabtai Tzvi, which they played a major role in, the decision over, they were one of the deciders over whether he was the Messiah or not, and even they continued some of their work into the founding of Hasidism. So we'll discuss that in general. So first, Rav Mordechai Yaffe. Rav Mordechai Yaffe is known as the Baal HaLevushim. The reason he's known as the Baal HaLevushim is because every one of his svarim is called the Levush something. The Levush Malchus, the Levush this, the Levush that. Every one of his, every book that he wrote is called the Levush, the garment. So he's referred to, you'll see in halachic literature and otherwise, as the Levush. But his name was Rav Mordechai Yaffe. As you can see here, he lived from 1530 to 1602. He was born in Prague, and he spent most of his life studying under the two major halachic figures of the time, the Rav Ma, Rav Moshe Isserles, and the Maharshal, Rabbi Shlomo Luria. We know about them that there was, even though the Maharshal and the Rav Ma were friends and related, there was a bit of tension or philosophical tension between the two of them. The Rama was in favor of codification of the codification, and obviously he was the author of the Shulchan Aruch, or the Mapa on the Shulchan Aruch, the tablecloth on the Shulchan Aruch, and he was in favor of a codifying and universalization of Jewish law. And the Maharshal felt that this was bold and audacious. To create one singular law, he felt, takes away the power of the posek to interpret based on the Gemara. He very eloquently defends the status of the Gemara as the one and only authoritative text in Torah Shebaal Peh. The Mishnah and the Gemara is the one and only authoritative text, and everything else is just commentary and therefore open to interpretation. So interestingly enough, Rav Mordechai Yaffe finds himself as a student of these two kind of major figures, so he's benefiting from those two very different perspectives. A second kind of tension that existed that we saw between the Rama and the Maharshal in past shiurim is the Rama was more open to secular studies, delving in, not extensively, but somewhat, into the realms of philosophy, and his gateway to that was the Rambam's Mor Nevuchim, and the Maharshal was hardly critical of him, feeling that, in his words, the Torah was lovesha tzak va'efer, the Torah was wearing sackcloth and dust over the fact that the Rama was studying secular education. It's unclear, at the beginning of Rav Mordechai Yaffe's career, which path he's going to take, or is he going to take a middle ground. But in 1561, he spends 10 years in Italy, and he comes back not only someone with a very broad secular education, but also someone who is well-versed in Kabbalah, particularly Lurianic Kabbalah. So this time in Italy seems to have a really profound effect on Rav Mordechai Yaffe, the Levush, and it puts him kind of into the camp of his Rebbe, the Rama, and away from the Marsha. In 1599, he's named Rabbi of Posen. This is a significant position. The reason it's a significant position is because it's the largest and most influential city in all of Poland. Jew or non-Jew. Real estate in Posen was prime, to the point where we're going to see the Council of the Three Lands or the Council of the Four Lands, depending on which era in history it was, had to take positions at various points on who and when people were allowed to move in, when they were allowed to have status. Because if you live there, Posen, what made it a powerful and influential city was that it was right on the trade routes for that area of Europe. And therefore, if you were there, chances are you had a lot of opportunities in terms of trading, in terms of money lending, in terms of money changing, in terms of if you owned an inn, that would be also extraordinarily lucrative. It was an area which was the major player, I guess we would call it the New York City of its time, in that area of Poland. So for him to be named Rabbi of Posen was no small feat. In another sense, also, he was very much a student of the Rama. What is his justification for authorship of the Levush? Why does he write it? So number one is he felt that the Shulchan Aruch and the Beis Yosef in particular was not concise. He felt that it was overly involved. It was overly involved in too much pilpul, in the discussion of what the halacha should be, and he felt someone should just set out what exactly halacha is and state it out outright without any kind of differentiation or discussion of varying opinions. That was number one. So he wanted to write a more concise version of the Shulchan Aruch. And number two, he says he felt it would be more accessible to the layperson. He felt that the Shulchan Aruch was too much of an insider's work. For the Yeshiva Bachar, it was the perfect work because it summarized all the various opinions in the sugya and came to a clear conclusion depending on whether you're Ashkenaz or Sfar. But he felt that there needed to be something which, you know, the regular Polish Yid could potentially read as kind of a kitzer, a short version. It was a short version in six volumes, but nonetheless a short version for those days.
Is it the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch?
No, it's not the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch. The Kitzur Shulchan Aruch was written by a person by name Rabbi Shlomo Gansried, who was Hungarian and I believe lived in the 19th century. So it's much later. Rav Yishua Falk, Katz, from last week, from our shir from last week, the Prisha, was highly critical of this work. Remember, Rav Katz felt that there was a need to understand a source for what it's worth, and in his introduction to the Sma, the Sefer Mirati Naim, where he summarizes his perspective on learning, he does take a shot across the bow at the Levush, feeling that the Levush was overly simplifying the discussions, and if anything, he thought the Shulchan Aruch was too simple. So just to know, there's no existence without controversy, and his later contemporary, the Rav Falk, was very critical of the Levush for his work. Interestingly, one contemporary, the Tzemach David, who's Rav David Gans, you can see here 1541 to 1613, so when he refers to Levush, he refers to him as one of the foremost judges of the Council of the Three Lands. All right, so the question is, what does that mean he was the foremost judge of the Council of the Three Lands? And what was the Council of the Three Lands? So number one is, as Rabbi of Posen, which for a while the Maharal was also the Rabbi of Posen, that was an extraordinarily influential position. You're basically the leading rabbi in all of Poland, except for maybe Lublin. You are the force to be reckoned with. That's who you were. And therefore it would make sense that you would be on the Council of the Four or the Three Lands. So first of all, what's the reason for the Council? What are the Four Lands and what are the Three Lands? So the Four Lands are Upper Poland, Lower Poland, Ukraine, and Lithuania. Those are the Four Lands. Okay, what we might call in this day and age Galicia, and what?
Plus.
Yeah, that's it. It becomes the Pale of Settlement, whatever it is. This was the newest settlement of Jews, right? Jews who have been kicked out of Western Europe in various areas. are now going to be settling in Poland. And the Polish government is happy to have them to a certain extent, but you know, if you want to play the tune, you got to pay the piper. So what does that mean? They wanted to collect taxes, and they found collecting taxes from Jews was not the simplest thing to do. Jews don't like to part with their money. So therefore, they agreed I know this is going on tape and everything, right? Okay? So they agreed, the Polish government agreed, and in fact supported the creation of a council run by Jews and for Jews, which would answer to the Polish government, which would exist in order, first and foremost, in order to collect taxes on behalf of the Polish government, to decide how the taxes would be levied. And the Polish government would tell the Council of the Four Lands, listen, from the Jewish community, we're expecting X amount of taxes. You decide how to levy it. So, you know, depending on who's elected, you know, if it's a, you know, if it's a democratic, head of the Council of the Four Lands, so you know he'll tax the rich and he'll give breaks to the poor. If it's a Republican one, he'll give breaks to the wealthy and practice trickle down halacha. Okay, that would be the difference. Okay, fine.
The problem is they're all in the cash business.
So the truth is, it's the perfect way to collect because you can't even say you're in a cash business, you're not reporting it, because it's your fellow Jew, because someone's got it. So, listen, the Jewish community has to pay X amount of taxes. So, you know, someone's going to get beat up and someone's going to get hurt for it. So it actually proved to be, pragmatically, for the Polish government, a very good way. And again, remember, the Jews are very much involved in government collection, etc. So they would be interested in seeing to it that their things get paid in a timely fashion. So in 1623, Lithuania seceded to form its own council. This had to do with a lot of Polish politics. Lithuania and Ukraine in general were not natural parts of Poland. Poland was this great imperial power in those days. So, again, this was more just in terms of those politics. So depending on what year you're talking about, you either call it the Council of the Four Lands or the Council of the Three Lands, depending on whether Lithuania is included. It is founded, I wrote here, circa 1580, because no one's really 100% sure when it was founded. What we can say, though, is once it was founded, they were impeccable about the keeping of their books, right? There are these consistent pinkasim, they're called, which, I mean, I guess in modern terminology, we would call them the minutes of the meetings. They would meet twice a year in Lublin. And twice a year in Lublin, they would meet usually in Elul time and then another time later in the year around Pesach time. They would be meeting, and they would discuss the various issues that were on the table, and they would also institute various forms of takanot. So one of the things I did for you here is I thank God for the Bar Ilan, I was able to, you could do just a search for Vad HaArba Artzot, and you could find basically every takana. So rather than, meaning I could just tell you the history, but you could just as easily, you know, do a search online for a good article on the Vad HaArba Artzot and do the history, but I'm going to give you a little bit of the halacha that goes along with the history, which I guess is part of the raison d'etre of this class in general. So what was the structure of the Council of the Four Lands? So you start off with a parnas. Your parnas is your, for lack of a better word, your president, your chairman of the board. He's your god. Then you have your ne'emanim, or your ne'eman. What's a ne'eman?
Trustees.
A trustee, right? Very good. A trustee, right? Then you have your shtadlan. This is very important. Your shtadlan, for lack of a better word, is lehishtadel, means to try or to attempt. This is your foreign minister. Who is your shtadlan? Your shtadlan is your messenger that you're going to send to the Polish government if you need an advocate on behalf of the Jewish community. You have your kotev, who is your recording secretary, and you have your shamayim, who are the local grunts who do the work that are necessary for the council. One of the things that you discover is that there was an often contentious balance between rabbinic and lay leadership on this board. In fact, to the point where in later councils, they actually limited the amount of rabbis who were allowed to be on the board. Although, they said that there are certain things that were only under halachic jurisdiction, and they spent all their time arguing what was halacha and what was politics. Okay, so you could see just, I don't know how to say it in Polish, but in French they say, plus ça change, plus ça le même chose. You know, the more things change, the more they stay the same. But and again, depending on the period of time, how powerful the rabbi was, the rabbinic figure was, that's how powerful the rabbinic say would be on the council of the four lands in general. And I'll give you just some of the branches that were existing here in the council of the four lands, and just so we can discuss some of them. So number one is there was the legislative branch of the legislative actions of the Council of the Four Lands. So just to give you an example of some things, in 1583, one of the more famous regulations that lasted for generations was basically the rules that would exist in Poland for the hiring and firing of rabbis. How their contracts should be made up. So I guess this was the early versions of the National Council or the Rabbinical Council of America. I don't know, however you want to say it. But they had very clear regulations. How rabbis were to be hired, what salaries they should be paid, what communities were entitled to, how many rabbis they were entitled to within their community, and also what the authority of the rabbi was. Remember, the rabbi of a community was not the guy who you called when there was a funeral or something like that. The rabbi of the community was the person who was in charge of kashrus and shchita and all these various other and din, and the rabbi is the one who's going to be who's in charge of the court system. We'll get into the legislative. Into the more in terms of the legislative system that was going on, or the judicial system, I should say, that was going on there. But the rabbi was very much a religious political position, very much like, I don't know, you would call him the mayor even, in a lot of senses of the word, because he's controlling a good portion of what's going on within the community. Also, there was a regulation of money lending. Remember, we all know the famous rule, which is money makes money. Right, that's the way you make money. This rule has been true for time immemorial. But what's the problem with money making money in the Jewish community? Money's not allowed to make money. Right, the rule that the Chumash sets down, interpreted in the Gemara in Bava Metzia, is that I can't you spending time with my money, I can't make money off of that. Right, that I'm not allowed to take ribbis. That's what it's called. I'm not allowed to take interest on a loan from one Jew to another Jew. So one of the institutions that was promoted, it had existed for a while already, but one of the institutions that's promoted by the Council of the Four Lands is the consistent use of the Heter Iska. The Heter Iska is such a powerful document that chances are, if you own Israel bonds, you have signed a Heter Iska and you don't even realize it. In fact, I will tell you, when I signed the mortgage on my house, I signed a Heter Iska because there are a number of Jewish board members on whatever bank I was borrowing from, and I had to sign a Heter Iska. What is the Heter Iska? The Heter Iska is basically a document which turns every loan into an investment. Rather than loaning you money, what am I doing? I am investing in your company and expecting a return on that investment. Okay? And basically, you have to bring me proof for what it is that you did with my money. If you can't bring me proof, you have to pay dmei hispashrus, which is basically an investment deal, right? So basically, you say that we agree that if you can't bring me proof, what happened to my money? What do? You agree to pay some sort of agreed upon money, which might turn out to about 7% per year. Okay, that's the way it works. Okay, it just happens to be. Okay, yeah, that's the Heter Iska, but it's promoting it, and also particularly in Posen, in the area of Lavush, there was a lot of debate over again who gets to live and work and be considered a citizen of Posen again with all the benefits that go along with being in Posen. So the Council of the Four Lands would regulate who would be allowed to do that, and there are all these chuvos over, you know, this guy claims to have rights to this land because he inherited it from this person, and this person came, and all these things are going to be coming before the Council of Four Lands, and the Council of the Four Lands is going to set up standards for this area in terms of living.
Is the Polish government approved of all of this?
Correct. The Polish government, like again, this is a win-win situation as far as they're concerned. What are they interested in? They're interested in the Jews being controlled, The Jews having a legal system and paying their taxes. Probably not in that order. Okay, they're probably interested first and foremost in paying their taxes. And so, if the Council of the Four Lands is getting me taxes, what do I care how they get it? What do I care if they, find one rich guy in Posen who's going to pay all the taxes for the entire Jewish community? I don't care. I get my money in the end.
And they do pay consistently?
Yes, yes. And in fact, the Council of the Four Lands really took upon themselves that responsibility to see to it that it got paid. Yes, ma'am. Yes, sir. Oh, so that leads us into the administrative responsibilities. Oh, yeah. No, I'm getting there. That leads us into the administrative responsibilities of the Council of the Four Lands.
Wait, I got a quick question about the Heteriska.
Yeah.
Did that 7% number ever change with the current economy?
Yeah, whatever the interest going interest rate was, that's what the Heteriska would be. Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. The truth is, today, if you want to see some research on it, but today you can actually prove. It's a big problem in Israel. You can actually prove what you paid for your house and what happened to the money. So you could potentially go to the bank and say, I'm not paying you Dmei Hispashrus. I'm not paying you our agreement deal because you know exactly what happened to the money. I put it on this house right here. The value of the house is listed publicly, so don't be telling me you don't know what happened to my money. That's what happened to my money. I'm not paying you interest anymore. And that's what the document says. So, I don't know, no one's taken it to the Israeli Supreme Court yet, but there's a potential, that's a binding legal document. There's a potential there. So, although remember, if it fails, it means we all lose our Israel bond money. So, collection of taxes, again, was one of the, from the Polish government's perspective, that was the primary responsibility of the Council of the Four Lands. But also, if the taxes were ever felt to be overly excessive, or if there was ever a feeling that they were mistreating the Jewish community in any way, this is what you would have shtadlanim. Who are shtadlanim? Shtadlanim were foreign ministers. This is the person you would send to the king of Poland, the ruler of Poland, and you would send him there, and he would beseech on behalf of the Jewish community for various things. People would actually hire shtadlanim for personal things. If I felt like I in particular was being mistreated by the government in any way, I would go over and hire a shtadlan to go and do work for me and to go advocate for me on behalf of me in front of the Polish government. Interestingly enough, there was a lot of debate over the shtadlanim were ethical people or not. A lot of people felt that some of the shtadlanim, some historians feel that some of the shtadlanim were actually people who were just in it to make a buck and didn't really have any. Yeah, of course. Meaning, listen, you take a guy who's in a bad situation. What choice does he have? And you can blackmail him for all the money, in the world. But there were shtadlanim who took upon themselves the responsibility of protecting the Jewish community and advocating to lower taxes, to spread out the taxes, to hold off on the taxes, whatever it was that they needed on behalf of the Jewish community. Yeah. No, they would go to the king. You're never going to go to Rome. You're never going to go to Rome. You're going to go to the king. Right? Yeah. All right. So interestingly enough, there's a Shla, the Shnei Lechos Habris, who's a contemporary of the Council of the Four Lands. So he has a line, it's a philosophical work, and you'll just see how he uses the Shtadlan to his advantage in a philosophical work. I just thought it was an interesting thing. He says, a person, he goes and beseeches God for various things in his life. He says, anything a person does, or says, or thinks in his heart before God, this is a great and wonderful thing. So in the first parak of Avodah Zarah, it says, so when Rabbi Eliezer was captured and accused of apostasy, so they brought him up for judgment. Amar Leoso Hegmon. So the ruler said to him, Zakin Shekamosa Yatchok Bidvarim Betelim Halalu. He says, you, this elderly gentleman, you should involve yourself in such petty things. Amar Le Neman Alay Adayin Katsavur Osa Hegmon Alav Hu Omer. So he says the judge, he says about him, is faithful to me, will be my faithful. So the hegmon, the leader, thought he was talking about him. And he said, and he didn't realize that he was talking about who is my trustee, who is Rabbi Eliezer saying was his trustee, not this ruler over here, but actually HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So he says, and the same thing, Esther, every time it says HaMelech in Megillat Esther, so Chazal tell us, it's not referring to Ahasuerus, but it's actually referring to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Ima HaMelech Tov, Ima Tzatzi, Chein Bein HaMelech. Right? And what does he say here? Kol Kavanat Liba, Haytal HaMelech Malchei HaMelechim HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That everything, that her entire intent was not to beseech before Ahasuerus, but she was actually beseeching before God. V'chein bin Nehemia, and so too by Nehemia, v'espalel lokei shamayim, v'omer la-melech im ala-melech tov, etc. All of these melech, every time it's referring to melech, they're beseeching a human king, but in fact they're prostrating themselves before melech malchei ha-melechim ha-kadosh baruch hu. And he says, v'eini ani tarich l'masha kasav Rashi, v'kacha yeh b'leiv kol shtadlan. He says, this is my advice to all the shtadlanim, that when they go before the king of Poland, and they say, oh, please, king, you know, do this on behalf of the Jewish community, or, oh, please, king, do this. They should be closing their eyes and thinking not of this, you know, human king, but they should be thinking like Esther, like Rabbi Eliezer, like Nehemiah. They should be thinking of Melech Malchei HaMelechim, the HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And there are all these stories, about shtadlanim and the various kind of tricks that they would use. They would start off with the political, the philosophical, the rational, all the way down to, you know, throwing themselves on the mercy of the court and crying and bawling and screaming before the Polish government to have compassion upon the Jewish people. The Pisrei Tshuva actually quotes here in Choshen Mishpat, he actually quotes some of the rules that were instituted for what shtadlanim could charge. You know, there were limits on what they could charge. He says, "Umisha shaleach shtadlan datzur shiasa kafi sichlo." He says, whenever you hire a shtadlan, you don't. This was the halacha for a shtadlan. I go over to Mr. Shtadlan and I say, I need you, you know, the government's picking on me. I need you to get them off my back. So you give the shtadlan money. The question is, does that mean the shtadlan has to act exactly the way I do? I say he has to act, or is he free to use whatever he thinks will work? Why is this bad? Because he could say Weissman is, you know, nuts. He's clinically insane, and thus get me out of my taxes. You know, but you know, now everyone thinks I'm insane. So the Pisrei Tshuva says, no. The way you hire a shtadlan is you hire a shtadlan, and he does it. You know, you hire him. Don't ask questions how he gets done. You're not paying the taxes. That's the nature of the agreement that people would have with shtadlanim. It's just kind of, there's a whole bunch of interesting types of conversations and halachos that came up, that came along with the shtadlan. So that was one of the responsibilities of the Council of the Four Lands, was to hire shtadlanim, or to have a shtadlan on call who would be there to advocate on behalf of the Jewish community. Number three, the third responsibility that existed within the Council of the Four Lands was a judicial responsibility. They would judge disputes between cities and individuals. This is where Rav Mordechai Yaffe probably found his place most. As rabbi of Posen, he was also probably a rabbinical court judge, and therefore he would often find himself deciding on cases of tort law, of cities going one against the other. And interestingly enough, the Council of the Four Lands didn't have a constitution. They had halacha. That was their deciding factor on all issues. That's why, like I said, Choshen Mishpat, the laws, tort law, and laws of damages, and the laws of business arrangements, that was very much living law to the people living in 16th and 17th century Poland, and it was coming before a governing body which took that responsibility very seriously. Interestingly enough, here we have, I brought you a quote here from one of the Pinkasim, one of the minutes of one of the meetings of the Council of the Four Lands relating to the judicial. He says, he says, from our perspective, and God forbid if it's not our authority, you know, the monarchs are modern. V'otikanenu, he says, this is one of our takanos, this is one of our establishments. Shebechol yirid v'yirid shebelublin yivaru roshim anal shlosha dayanim. So in each and every community within Lublin, there should be three rabbinical court judges. Hanal shlosha dayanim liyosa muchanim liyeshev bedin shmo ben achayhem kegadol v'katatan. There should be in each community three judges who will be able to hear the various claims that people might have, and all of their word is law, and all of their decisions are binding to be enforced by us, with all powers that the shul will have. And again, the shul was the enforcers of any punishment. Because if someone refuses, let's say, to pay their money, so before going to the Polish government, which they would sometimes go to enforce the decisions of the Council of Four Lands, what would they do? They would start with excommunication. Would you think, all right, but what's the big deal? Excommunication, they don't let me in this shul, means they let me... No. The Council of the Four Lands decides that you are excommunicated, you're not allowed in any shul. That's the, and anyone who has contact with you, they themselves can be excommunicated. So this was fairly serious idea. And it basically created requirements. If someone refused to pay a certain money and they excommunicated him, it would mean that in every shul on Shabbos, they would be required to announce that so-and-so has refused to pay his money that was decided by the certain district court, which was acting under the authority of the Council of the Three Lands and the Council of the Four Lands, and therefore he is hereby excommunicated. Anyone who has any contact with him, etc., with him, with his wife, with his children, etc. So the judicial part of the Council of the Four Lands was also something that had a good deal of authority and power within 15th and 16th, 16th and 17th century Poland.
And could they punish crimes?
Yeah, they did everything. Yeah. Like I said, this is the governing body of the Jewish community in Poland.
The last few words, the Tafsovi Dei Goyim, they could use the military, the government.
They would use, if someone broke the law, again, this is where the halachos of Mesira came in, and the assumption is that since the Polish government or the Polish authorities were acting on the authority of the Jewish court of law, so you weren't being moser them to din. You were,
you could call it Messiah,
right? This person broke the law. You're punishing him for breaking the law. It's no.
But you're using not the Jewish authority, but you're using the government authority.
Correct. Because the Jews don't have a standing army.
Saying,
you know.
It's interesting that today that would be frowned upon. Who are you calling the police? You can't call the police.
Right. Oh yeah. No. For sure. Yeah.
Precisely that.
Yeah, well, they were in charge of the police. So yeah, all right. So then finally, their final responsibility was cultural and religious. They set up kosher standards. They set up modesty standards, which was kind of interesting. They were very, very fearful, it seems, of Jewish women becoming the victims of Polish peasant violence and rape, One of the reasons that Polish Jewry had the reputation for being as overly modest as they do may have started, I mean, it's a theory, but may have started because of that. Interestingly enough, there's stories of there about insisting that women shave their heads when they get married also. Again, this might be relating on making them not look good for the Goyim and not be victims of it.
Why shouldn't unmarried women do the same? I mean,
right. So there was this kind of undercurrent of modesty standards that were very interesting to them.
Was there an assimilation issue?
There was only one way to assimilate in those days: convert to Christianity. That was it. Either you were Jewish, you were dead, or you were Christian. So Polish peasants had zero education, okay? And one of the things I'm going to discuss is the Council of the Four Lands was very interested in seeing to it that the Jews did not succumb to the ignorances of the Polish peasantry. And they were very insistent on the setting up of school systems that would educate all of the Jews who were living, within their commonwealth. And one of the responsibilities that they took upon themselves was to see to it that every community had a yeshiva, a standing yeshiva that met standards that they would set up. It had to have a certain amount of teachers. It had to make sure that every child was educated. These are things that they took into that they took kind of very serious responsibility of. as much as women were included in those days? So the answer is no.
Where was the interaction? Weren't the Jewish communities all insulated?
Not totally. Remember, there are these super communities like Posen and Lublin and Vilna and Warsaw, which may have extraordinarily large Jewish populations, but they weren't totally isolated, but there were Poles living there also. Right? A lot of the Poles were involved in farming, and the Jews were not, generally. Okay. So just a couple of things in the halachos. So here a quote from the Pinkas of the Vada Arba Artzos. So it says here, quote, "Shelo le'achol ma'achal o yayin afilu mimi shemuchzak b'kashrus." Even if you know a guy to be kosher 100%, a frum a guy, don't eat his food or drink his wine. Elam yesh lo ksav hesher me'ezav beistin, unless he has a hesher, right? He's got to have a tudas kashrus on his wall. You can't just trust any Mo, Larry, or Curly, but he's got to have a tudas kashrus from an av beistin from the local local rabbi. So that's number. That's one there quoted in the Tshuvos HaHanhagos Krach Beis. The Shelos Tshuvos Beis Mordechai Chelik Aleph Simen Pei Dalid quotes Be'achad Hakinusim Shel Vada Arba Asnos Tiknu. What does it say? That it needs to cut down the expenditures related to the making of a wedding. In order, the investment should be less. But and to basically be consistent with the economic status of the couple getting married. This was, they said, in order not to embarrass the orphans who could potentially not make such large weddings. So therefore, they created standards for what a wedding, how much could be paid for Shabbos. And here, just an interesting thing: we all know there's the famous Gemara that it may or may not be usher to save a non-Jew on Shabbos. So they made a takana that refuas akum b'Shabbos was mutar, that Jewish doctors were permitted, if not commanded, to save non-Jews even on Shabbos, and to heal them even on Shabbos if it were so necessary. So here you see, in terms of cultural and religious investment, that the Vada Arba Artzos really took that responsibility as well.
I'm really surprised about the first part about the heksher, because I always thought, like in New York, before all the vads, you relied on the spirituality of the butcher.
So what happened? All the Polish Yidden came in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s, and they said, we can't do this anymore, so they set up Hechsherim.
They learned
from Poland. So it seems like they must have had an issue there with people being dishonest about their kashrus. Yeah.
The takana of Akum Refuah B'Shabbos.
Yeah.
That was based on Talmudic halacha.
Correct.
Rather than they make the takana.
No, correct. They just enforced it. Correct. No, meaning,
because
nothing we say, like, you know what I mean? It's like the old statement. Nothing we say is new. You know what I mean? We're not going to declare that, oh, this is the first time we're saying it, you know, but it's
clarified. Yes, go ahead. Exactly.
Other questions? All right. Did I deal with your the council beforehand?
Yeah,
it's just fascinating how you think of it as this backwater, but no, they really had an organized type of governmental system to control one of the largest Jewish communities of the time.
I would like to hear about how they fired rabbis.
So there was no tuition crisis because. No, because the Council of the Four Lands would collect as part of the
portion.
Exactly. But people, the wealthier families would pay an individual malami to teach their children also, yeah.
I don't know if you mentioned that. So, from the Polish government to the council, was there any instances where there was unreasonableness, like they wanted 500 times the collect rent?
Yes. That. Why do you think they had the Stadlin on the payroll?
Situations where the community couldn't raise the money, like in old days in Europe, when you had ransom someone, and they ask for...
So that is... So things are good at this point.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, at this point in Jewish history, before Chmielnitsky, things are fairly decent for the Polish Jewish community. Like, remember, this is the Golden Medina. This is, you know, what they call a Jewish paradise. You know, that's a...
Poland tried to get Polish Jews from Spain and all
over. Yeah, no. Poland was actively recruiting Jews. That's why it became the largest community in the world.
When
you know?
So they davened
Nusach Ashkenaz. Why? Because they were Ashkenazim. Who started davening Nusach Sfard? So 100 years later, Hasidim are going to pick up on Nusach Sfard because they felt it was the more authentic Nusach. But at the time, they're davening, they were Ashkenazim. They were mostly people coming from Western Europe who've been kicked out at various points.
The Polish Catholic Church is active, even at this time, trying to make the country more Catholic.
Hakesef yanes hakol, right? Money answers everything. And the Jews were the economic force in Poland at the time, which kind of leaves them vulnerable, not to the church, but to the Cossacks, who were very unhappy that they were being treated as second-class citizens by Poles, which we'll get to in future weeks, probably very soon, why the Cossacks were upset at the Jews in particular.
That's where the money is, so to
speak. They were the collectors. They were the collectors, so... That's where the Cossacks are going to be upset with. Yeah. All right. Shkayach. Thank you all.